problem. Everybody picks a side. Oh, my team won. It's not a team. It's not a team. We, the people, should be on the same team. You people need to understand where the enemy is, where the issues are. And that's in D.C. Those are the people that are running the country. I don't care if you voted for Trump. It doesn't matter to me. The spending is out of control. The wars are still going on in the Middle East. The troops are still not coming home. People are still streaming across the border. I know, I talk about this here on the program, and I get people all over.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Holding a line and doing a pretty damn good job.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heide and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
You need to have discussions. You need to have talks. Come on. You can talk.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience?
One of the things,
all the noise out there today, consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business.
We'll get together, we put down what we want to do, and let's figure it out, let's get it done.
7115.
The meeting lasts more than 5-10 minutes. I get annoyed. I got other things I've got to do. Got places I got to be. Things I got to do. People I want to see. Anyway, got to take a break. Watchdog on WallStreet.com. Watchdog on WallStreet.com. Newsletter. Consultations with our certified financial planners. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Watchdog on Wall Street.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, Hunterdon Chamber Radio.
I'm chairman of the Ambassador's
Committee of the
Chamber.
Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber
of Commerce,
the voice of business.
We contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Well, good afternoon on this Friday, January 17th, can you believe? Another weekend of football, although that's not what we're going to talk about right now. So what about the weather? Well, we have hazardous weather conditions are predicted. Doesn't seem possible if you look outside. It's such a beautiful day. Okay, so today, fair, about 30 degrees, so it's could be freezing tonight, and in fact, it's expected to have increasing clouds tonight, and low of about 16 degrees, so it is going to be cold out there, folks. Bundle up, and always, in my view, maybe that's because I grew up in Wisconsin, we always kept an extra coat in the car or truck, and a pair of what we used to call galoshes or boots, and you know, some warm gloves never can hurt in case you get stranded. But what's happening tomorrow? High of about 37 degrees, but then in the morning it's going to be much colder, and then there's snow predicted, about 60%, and then up to 100% snow likely, and then because of the temperature, it should turn into some snow and sleet. So be careful tomorrow. By tomorrow night, a wintry mix is likely, and that's why there's a hazardous conditions predicted. By Sunday, chance of snow, 30% in the morning, and then mostly sunny. So by game time tomorrow, or Sunday night, I should say, by football game time, it should be very nice, partly cloudy on Sunday night, and then Martin Luther King Day, for all you folks who don't have to work, is predicted to be mostly sunny, high of about 32 degrees. So, but be careful on Saturday and Saturday night and into Sunday morning because that kind of, especially the sleet and snow, because it's going to be cold enough to have a lot of ice underneath it. So, I'm Pat Smits. Today, the program, of course, is the law, and I will be back after I play one more spot from our sponsors.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Well, good afternoon. It's the law. I've talked about the weather for the weekend, and I guess it would be good thing we're not sitting outside tomorrow to watch football. Bit cold and snow and etc. And I've been there, done that, but just as glad not to have to do it this weekend. Frankly, I'd like to be in San Francisco. Well, I should say Santa Clara because I think it'll be nice weather for the game. But I really have some news that is a long time in coming, but I think it is very important. On Monday, January 13th, S-3528 was signed into law by Governor Murphy, and it's an important law. And I think for most of us, you know, sometimes the legislature seems to, you know, deal with trivia. But this really isn't, although for most of us it probably won't have any impact. But this new law provides for a simple and streamlined process to confirm parentage through adoption for married and civil union couples where they are both named as parents on the original birth certificate of the child and where there are no other parental rights to be terminated. So, well, that doesn't sound like it's, you know, much of a deal, right? Wrong. This is primarily in situations where the couple used a donor, and I'm not sure I ever realize some of these terms, but used donor gametes to achieve the pregnancy and any rights the donor child could have acquired as a genetic contribution were terminated by operation of law in the appropriate venue. So what does that mean? Sounds like a lot of legalese. Well, most of us are familiar with the fact that I guess the only way to say it is that men who donate their sperm that are
used to artificially inseminate women are not the biological father, not considered the biological father, have no rights and no responsibilities. They just have donated sperm. And this has been in effect for many, many, many years, so that someone who has decided to be a sperm donor does not have to worry about having any responsibilities or obligations for the child. So this however, what does this mean? Well, potential people who fit in to these criteria, and this is what's so significant, they will no longer be required to obtain a background check of the adopting parent, and the court appearance, if the application is complete with the required proofs, and they will no longer have to make that court appearance. And three, they will not have the substantial waiting period before the entry of judgment, as with a regular adoption. In other words, a regular adoption process is very lengthy, time-consuming, and often difficult. What we have in these situations is a couple who both want to be parents of the child, and in the case with two moms or two women, I guess I should say, one of them carries the baby during the pregnancy. And the problem was that the second parent was not considered a parent, had to go through an adoption process that was very long and difficult. So in now what will happen is a couple will receive a judgment of adoption, as with a second parent or other adoption process used for years to confirm parentage. So it won't be a separate, different, more difficult process. This process is a means of obtaining a confirmation of parentage supporting the marital presumption under New Jersey's UPA and providing judgment that's universal and providing judgment that is entitled to full faith and credit in other states. So this law is also useful for different sex couples where there has been use of a donor gametes to confirm the parentage of a non-genetic parent. Second, where the former spouses or civil union partners, the child was born into the marriage but never adopted by the non-genetic parent. And the two people who, you know, really hats off because they did most of the work to get this statute passed and actually wrote the statute is Deborah Gustin. And Deborah is the attorney with Gustin & Gustin who, you know, she's my go-to person on any adoption. But certainly this statute is a victory for LGBTQ families and anyone else who are using donors to build their families. So Deb, along with Bill Singer, another attorney, and a lesbian family that was required to use the second parent adoption process, which included the background check, court appearance, etc. As a result, Deb and Bill drafted a new law that streamlines the process for certain families using either assisted reproduction to build their, well, it's not, it is, in fact, they're using assisted reproduction to build their families. So, as I indicated, Governor Murphy signed the law on January 13, 2020. So, again, the new law affects LGBTQ couples who, one, are married or in a civil union, two, have used an anonymous donor where the donor's parental rights have been terminated by operation of law, and that's what happens automatically if there's an anonymous donor, and three, where the adopting parent is the child's, where the adopting parent is on the child's birth certificate. So this is what has to happen. When the child is born, the other parent has to be named on the birth certificate. But it works as follows. There's no background check for the adopting parent. There's no court appearance if the application meets all the criteria. The applicant must submit the original marriage or civil union certificate, meaning a certified one. The original birth certificate of the child must be certified. And then there's an affidavit that has to be signed proving there is no other legal parent. So this could include proof from the fertility clinic as to the status of the donor. The application is filed in the same way an adoption would be filed with the filing fee. So as indicated, if accepted, the couple will receive a judgment of adoption, just as with the old process, but it will cost substantially less money and less time. So it's not only available for same-sex couples, but it would be also available for different-sex couples, i.e. man and woman, where the donor gametes have been used and will confirm parentage on any non-biological parent. So it does that also. And it cannot be used, however, and this is important, it can't be used in step-parents or second-parent adoptions where there was a home insemination. So this is important, apparently. And if the known donor did not go through a process in the state of conception where his rights were terminated or where the child was born into a prior relationship. So there are still some situations where this statute is not applicable. However, it is, for most people, this is going to make the process so much easier. And I don't have Bill's telephone number or address, but Deborah Gustin is in Glen Rock. She does this kind of work all over the state. Her number is 201-447-6660. I'd be more than happy if anyone needs more information. I do not do adoptions, but I would be happy to refer you to Deborah or Bill Singer, because they both handle this, and it is going to make that process so much easier. I mean, frankly, adoption, unless there's a contested situation, should be made easier. It is a long, drawn-out process in most states. And, of course, the agencies need to protect children, and so I'm not saying that there should not be background and other checks in situations where it is stranger adoption. But it can be very difficult for families without a lot of means who very often want to adopt a relative, and very, very common. Sometimes, in fact, the child is never adopted, even though raised by other family members, just because they don't want to have to go through the process. So that was an important piece of legislation and will make things much easier and streamline the process as it should be. So I'll be back in a minute, just going to let you know from a couple of our other sponsors.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hello, we're back. It's the law. Just trying to see. Not a lot has been going on, not a lot of significant cases, but... there's And when I say not a lot of significant cases, not a lot of cases where we have published opinions. There was a published opinion criminal case. That was a Supreme Court case, so we always look at any cases that are Supreme Court case because they're always published and they're precedent, and the Supreme Court, you know, does not take every case up from the appellate division, even when people file for certification. So this is dealing with a juvenile. So it was State of New Jersey in the interest of AA, and the state appealed from the appellate division's judgment reversing the defendant juvenile's adjudication of delinquency. And the trial court had adjudicated the child delinquent based on two counts of aggravated assault and related weapon charges. So what happened is a police officer in this case witnessed three males on bicycles heading east down the street. About 15 seconds later, the officer heard 8 to 10 gunshots coming from the east. The officer reported the gunshots along with a description of the three males. Now, these three black males, African-American, black, whichever term you want to use, but that was the fact. One of the issues is, you know, was that, did he have any really reason other than they saw these three black men or boys riding bicycles? So two of the victims were found in the directions that the males were seen riding. So the defendant was stopped. This is AA. He was stopped and, based on the officer's identification, was taken into custody and brought to a juvenile facility. Now, remember, at that time, the officer didn't see the defendant except as riding a bicycle. So the police contacted the juvenile's mother, who was taken to an interview room and told why the defendant was under arrest. She became visibly upset, I can certainly understand why, and requested to speak to the defendant. And although we say defendant, this is a boy. And when I say boy, he was underage. So, you know, when the officer saw three boys, he was certainly under the age of 18, riding down the street on the bikes. So when she requested to speak to her son, the officer took her to the holding cell where he was being held. And the police allowed him and his mother to speak through the cell gate. However, five officers were in the room. A detective in the room testified that he overheard the conversation between the defendant and his mother, during which the defendant admitted that he was on the street where the shooting took place and told his mother, they jumped us last week. So he was then charged with attempted murder and weapons offenses. And at the hearing, the delinquency hearing, the state introduced the conversation between the defendant and his mother. The state also introduced surveillance video that was not clear enough to identify any person. So this is what the court was looking at when this case went up first to the appellate division. And so this is what the Supreme Court had. But it was not clear enough to identify any of the bicycles. None of the physical evidence connected the defendant to the shooting. Now, although the trial court adjudicated the defendant delinquent based on the officer's testimony, the appellate division reversed and remanded for a new hearing. So on appeal, the court affirmed the appellate division's judgment, meaning when on appeal to the Supreme Court, the New Jersey Supreme Court affirmed the appellate division's judgment, ruling that the police officer's actions amounted to an interrogation, and As a result of that, the defendant should have been advised of his Miranda rights in his mother's presence and should have been permitted to speak with his mother in private. Frankly, I think they had it spot on because, you know, and hopefully this boy wasn't involved in the shooting. However, the evidence was so flimsy, and to have a juvenile not be able to speak privately with a parent, to be interrogated in this way, this is just not the way it's done or should not be done, and that's what the Supreme Court, why they decided the way they decided on that. And, you know, I understand that the police have a burden, but they certainly had more of a burden than a police officer just showing and seeing kids, you know, riding bicycles down the street. And if that was their best evidence, shame on them. So, what about, there was a commercial law case where the, this was Triffin versus Pennsylvania Transport Authority. This is the appellate division, and the plaintiff appealed from the dismissal of his complaint. And so he, this was a dismissal of his complaint seeking damages for a dishonored check. And he filed suit against the defendant along with two other people. And defendant appeared without asserting any affirmative defenses, and the other defendant defaulted. At trial, the defendant argued that the check in question was a payroll check issued to one of the men who allegedly informed the defendant that the check had been lost. So in other words, it was a payroll check. The defendant told his employer that it had been lost, and so subsequently the defendant issued a replacement check, meaning the employer issued a replacement check. And, however, both the original and the replacement check ended up being negotiated. So then the plaintiff argued that the defendant's negligence caused a loss for plaintiffs, assigned Asinor, who allegedly cashed one of the two checks. The trial court itself raised the issue of whether it could exert personal jurisdiction over the defendant, and concluding without any sworn statements that the defendant had no presence or continuous and systematic contacts with New Jersey, the trial court dismissed the plaintiff's complaint. On appeal, the plaintiff argued the defendant had waived the issue of personal jurisdiction and that the trial court erred in dismissing the action by assuming material facts not in evidence. So the defendant argued that plaintiff's appeal was untimely and that the trial court could, sua sponte, raise the issue of personal jurisdiction. So the appellate court ruled that the plaintiff's appeal was timely as it was filed exactly 45 days after the finality of the case was achieved. So that it, there's a 45-day window that you have to file the appeal. And they said that that day was when the last remaining defendant was voluntarily dismissed from the case. So the court then reversed and remanded the dismissal of the action, noting that unlike subject matter jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction was a waivable defense. The court held that the trial court could not sua sponte raise the issue of personal jurisdiction when it had not been timely asserted by the defendant. So that's important. The defendant has to come in and say no jurisdiction. And in any event, the court ruled that even if the trial court were to entertain this defense, it should have adjourned to allow the parties to present competent evidence on the defendant's presence or contacts with New Jersey. So there has to be, in this case, there had to be personal jurisdiction, but if the trial judge questioned whether or not there was personal jurisdiction, trial judge had to, adjourn to give the plaintiff time to show that, in fact, there were sufficient contacts with New Jersey to so that the state of New Jersey has, in fact, personal jurisdiction over the defendants. So I know those are some legal, kind of legalese, but in fact, you cannot be sued. Someone just can't up and sue you out in Montana, and you have to, and require you to respond. Or let's say in New Jersey, you can't just up and sue somebody in Montana and expect them to litigate the case in New Jersey unless there are sufficient contacts with New Jersey that makes it reasonable. Governor Murphy also signed some bills dubbed the Kitty Brennan bills, and they were named after the woman who went public with allegations that she was raped by a colleague while working on the gubernatorial campaign in 2017. So there were these now were statutes that were now in law as a result of that. And probably many people heard about that case, so that I have not read these statutes, but that is certainly there were a number of bills being presented with respect to that after that happened and the accusations were made. There was, and I'm not sure I know much about this. I don't know much about it, but there was a bill to ban the use of a what they call gay or trans panic, quote gay or trans panic, end quote, defense in criminal cases in New Jersey courts, where a defendant claims provocation by sudden knowledge of the victim's sexual orientation or gender, and apparently. A ban against it, in other words, B-A-N, passed by the Assembly this week, 76-0 on a concurrence vote. So that, apparently that has been attempted to use that as a reason, and that statute is going into effect. I don't know much more about it other than it's, you can't use that any longer. It's not for publication, so obviously this is not something that you can use as precedent. A case called Gaeta v. Hendel. And in that case, the defendants appealed an award of counsel fees to plaintiffs pursuant to the frivolous litigation statute. And in this case, the plaintiffs and defendants were neighbors and parties to litigation resulting from disputes over their shared property lines. So from this standpoint, important because, you better know what your property lines are out there. And this is a case that started because there were disputes over shared property lines. Now, as a part of that litigation, defendants were ordered to pay counsel fees to plaintiffs. Now, then what happened is the defendants filed a Chapter 11 bankruptcy petition, and the judge in the property settlement dispute case, not the bankruptcy case, calculated the actual fee amount and entered an order because it violated the bankruptcy code's automatic stay provision. Then the bankruptcy petition was then dismissed a few months later. Having been informed of the dismissal, the property dispute judge, sua sponte, meaning himself or herself, reinstated the counsel fee order. On appeal by defendants, the court affirms, concluding that once the bankruptcy action was dismissed, then precedent allows reinstatement of the obligation. So that was, because that was dismissed, they had the right, and the award of the counsel fees occurred before the bankruptcy petition was filed. So there's no basis that pre-bankruptcy order is not to be reinstated. So that can be really important because there are people who file for bankruptcy to avoid orders. So as I said, that was not a published case, but it certainly will be helpful. There was another Plaza Court versus the City of Long Branch, again, not published, but of interest to some people because of the issues. So the plaintiff filed suit to challenge the local property tax assessments for its single-family residence. Boy, wouldn't we all like to do that. The city filed counterclaims for each tax year at issue. At trial, the differences between the party's experts were their evaluation methodologies and definitions of the competitive market. So they each had to hire an expert. Their experts testified, and the plaintiff's expert defined the competitive market as including the neighboring boroughs of Monmouth Beach and Seabright and the West End section of the city, in addition to the section of the city where the property was located. So plaintiff's expert relied upon sales comparison approach to value the property. The city's expert limited the competitive market solely to the section of the city where the property was located, in addition to the neighboring boroughs of Deal and Allenhurst. Well, I can tell you, anyone who's used Deal, that they were going to come up with something a lot more. So the city's expert used the cost approach to value the property and the sales comparison approach only to support the cost approach's conclusion. Now, without even reading anything more, I can tell you that generally, it's not the cost of replacement, it's the fair market value is what's used for taxes. So in this case, the court affirmed the tax assessments under challenge. The court first rejected the plaintiff's expert's definition of the competitive market, finding that the plaintiff's expert failed to account for the tight-knit community aspect of, or the lack of commercial development in the section of the city where the subject property is located. And thus, because 10 of the 12 comparable properties used by plaintiff's expert fell outside the competitive market, the court ruled that his value conclusions were not persuasive. Now, although the court affirmed the city's, expert use of the cost approach, the court found that the expert's value conclusions were problematic due to deficiencies in computing the replacement costs of improvements. So the court further rejected the city expert's use of what we called a national update cost multipliers to trend estimated construction costs for the property on the assessment date. So that was that. And anyone who's handling real estate appeals from taxes, asking for a new reassessment, needs to really look very carefully at the cases. They come down all over. But certainly you don't want to be, you don't want that to be a problem. Okay. A municipal judge, don't tell me that judges and lawyers don't get in trouble. A municipal court judge accused of skirting courtroom procedure, cursing at court staff, and making harassing ex-party communications with the defendant, filed an answer to her ethics charges, vowing not to repeat the same mistakes. See what happens there. So the this was important not only for lawyers but for other people. The New Jersey Supreme Court agreed with the conclusion that the New Jersey Bar and others had that lawyers cannot be found to have breached any fiduciary duty or have engaged in conversion if they are not aware of any third-party claim on funds that they hold in trust. And if they hold, if, in other words, if we hold funds in trust and on behalf of a bona fide client, we have to do what the client instructs us to do unless we know that there's some hold on the funds. Now, for example, it's more difficult now for those attorneys who do real estate because they have to check and make sure that there's no child support judgments against someone who's selling property. And they have to check that out before they can, you know, close on the property because if there are such child support judgments, they have to be paid. So that is very significant, makes it more difficult. Now, they only have to check that in New Jersey. So if anyone from other than in New Jersey has child support and arrears, they really need to enter judgment against the person who owes it, who has real estate in New Jersey, have to enter the judgment here so it would be picked up when the property is sold. There was another approved for publication this week, criminal and evidence, and that is the state appealed from the appellate division's reversal of a defendant's conviction and remand for a new trial. So apparently, following the effective date of the 2010 amendment to the Wiretap Act, but prior to the court's decision in State versus Earls, the police obtained defendant's cell phone records without a warrant or court order by submitting and what we call exigent circumstances request to the defendant's cell service provider. Police at the time were investigating the murder of a victim whose charred body was found in the rear of the defendant's vehicle with multiple gunshot wounds. Later acquired information made the defendant a what they called a person of interest. Although the Superior Court, a judge was called on to issue warrants, police submitted what we call an exigent circumstances request to the cell phone provider. The records the police received made the defendant the target of the investigation. Thereafter, the police obtained three warrants, including a warrant for a wiretap of defendant's cell phone. At the trial, the defendant moved to have this suppressed. And he wanted that evidence suppressed. The trial court denied the motion, and defendant was convicted of murder and other things like desecration of human remains and related offenses. Now, the appellate division in that case reversed the conviction and remanded for a new trial, ruling that the trial court erred in not granting the defendant's request for certain jury instructions. So at the end of a criminal trial, the judge, of course, instructs the jury. And what the defendant had requested jury instructions on lesser included offenses of aggravated manslaughter and reckless manslaughter, and that the police's failure to obtain a warrant or court order for his cell phone records required suppression. So on appeal, the court affirmed the, now this one on appeal, this is, and when I said this is up to the Supreme Court. So what I'm saying is went from the trial court to the appellate court, and now the went up to the Supreme Court. So on appeal to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court affirmed the appellate division's judgment. The Supreme Court ruled that during the interim between the 2010 amendment to the Wiretap Act and the court's decision in an earlier case called Earls, people had a reasonable expectation of privacy in cell phone records, and thus the police were required to either obtain a warrant or court order or demonstrate exigent circumstances. The Supreme Court held that the police in this case could not demonstrate the existence of exigent circumstances. So in other words, that the suppression was required. So there was a case on employment benefits, and that was in this case. And so you always have to be real careful about doing these things. But the respondent in this case appealed from the decision ordering the respondent to reimburse the petitioner, who was respondent's employee, for the petitioner's prescribed use of medical marijuana following a work-related accident. And the petitioner in this case cross-appealed, arguing that the administrative court erred by not finding that the petitioner had 100% total and permanent disability. So what happened is petitioner was injured on a construction site when a concrete truck dumped its load on him. Wow, that's probably a pretty serious injury. And following the accident, petitioner immediately began experiencing lower back pain that radiated down into his legs. An MRI revealed disc herniation and bulging, and the petitioner was instructed to see a neurosurgeon. A respondent initially denied compensation, leading the petitioner to use his own private health insurance. He later underwent a laminectomy and decompression of nerve roots, which was unsuccessful in treating his severe pain. And the petitioner later underwent a lumbar fusion procedure. When his pain continued, he was prescribed opioid medication, the use of which led him to developing hyperalgia. I'm actually not sure how to pronounce this word. Hyperalgesia. Hyperalgesia. And then he began treatment with a physician who enrolled him in a medical marijuana program to enable him to stop taking opioids. Sounds like a good alternative. So respondent ultimately agreed to reimburse petitioner for his out-of-pocket expenses, and the court ordered the respondent to further reimburse the petitioner for cost of the medical marijuana. On appeal, the respondent argued that the Federal Controlled Substance Act preempted the Compassionate Use of Medical Marijuana Act, and so that the order violated the Federal Controlled Substance Act by requiring respondent to furnish petitioner with an illegal substance. And then further argued that the judge failed to consider whether medical marijuana was reasonable and necessary, whether that was a reasonable and necessary form of treatment. So the court in this case, the appellate division, affirmed the rulings, finding no conflict between the the CSA, the Controlled Substance Act, and the Medical Marijuana Act, because the respondent was not required to possess, manufacture, or distribute marijuana. The court further ruled that the petitioner's evidence of severe and chronic pain and numerous unsuccessful treatments supported the finding that medical marijuana was a reasonable and necessary treatment in this case. So that is going to be a lot of these cases in the future, I have a feeling. Well, let me go and play a few more spots and then be back to finish the program.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, we only have a few more minutes. I'm just trying to figure out what to talk about. There a case that thought might be of interest to some, but not obviously a little. The question here is whether or not there was frivolous pleadings. So what happened is this is Crawford versus Scalaglio, not sure I'm pronouncing that, appellate division case where the defendant, and I'll just call him defendant, Scalaglio, appealed from an order awarding the plaintiff's attorney fees and costs following the trial court's determination that the defendant's counterclaim constituted a frivolous pleading. Never want that to happen. However, plaintiff in this case had filed suit against the defendants arising from plaintiff's efforts to purchase property in Sea Isle City. Apparently, the defendants executed a memorandum of understanding with plaintiff in which they agreed to form an LLC that would purchase the property. However, following the purchase, they agreed that the plaintiff would obtain full ownership in the LLC via stock transfer from the defendants. The defendant then purchased the property in his own name, with funds plaintiff had deposited in the LLC account. Defendant asserted that he would transfer the property to the LLC when it was formed. However, he advised the plaintiff that there was a title lands issue with the property that could affect development. So then plaintiff and defendant then met. Then there must have been another defendant. This was the attorney. Plaintiff and the defendant met with this attorney, whom the plaintiff paid a retainer to pursue their claim against the title company. Defendant advised keeping the property the defendant attorney, this gets a little confusing because there's a defendant and the defendant and the attorney. So what happened is the plaintiff later discovered that the attorney never filed suit against the title company and also had represented his partner, I guess I should call him, in other matters, and had represented other individuals who attempted to purchase the property and faced the same title lands issue. After facing foreclosure, the co-owner was able to sell the property. However, the plaintiff received no compensation and discovered the sale after reviewing tax information. So what happened is the plaintiff filed against his former partners and then added the defendant attorney, claiming that he breached his duty, which was a fiduciary duty, by allowing the partners to violate her interest in the property. And so in any event, there were counterclaims against the plaintiffs, and the trial court later dismissed those complaints. The plaintiff successfully filed a motion for sanctions and attorney's fees, ruling that the attorney's counterclaim was frivolous, or the counterclaim was frivolous. And on appeal, the appellate division affirmed, noting that the trial court found that the defendant's claims were asserted to create leverage, and that's the only reason for the counterclaim. So pretty significant. And right now I am out of time. I'm going to go to the news, and then we'll be back with the sports guys. Have a good weekend. Watch football.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump is bolstering his legal team for his impeachment trial set to begin on Tuesday. USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes has more from Washington.
President Trump adding Kenneth Starr, Alan Dershowitz, and Robert Ray to the team that will be headed up by White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Starr led the investigation of now former President Bill Clinton, impeached by the House and acquitted by the Senate. Ray was also involved in that case, and Dershowitz is a longtime well-known legal scholar. For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
Snow and ice is causing potentially dangerous travel conditions in the Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, dumping up to a foot of snow in some places. Meanwhile, ice and freezing rain are causing headaches for some drivers in the panhandle of Texas and New Mexico. This is USA Radio News.
Here is some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or if you sign up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare. It's the affordable alternative to health insurance. And it's worked beautifully for 25 years. They have more than 400,000 members now around the country.